Revelation chapter 17 in the Pew Bible. It's found on page 1322. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and said to me, "Come, I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute who is seated on many waters, with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk. And he carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, and it had seven heads and ten horns. The woman was arrayed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and jewels and pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. And on her forehead was written a name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints, the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. But the angel said to me, 'Why do you marvel? I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with seven heads and ten horns that carries her. The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction. And the dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come.' This calls for a mind of wisdom. The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated. They are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other has not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain only a little while. As for the beast that was and is not, it is an eighth, but it belongs to the seven, and it goes to destruction. And the ten horns that you saw are ten kings who have not yet received royal power, but they are to receive authority as kings for 1 hour together with the beast. These are of one mind, and they hand over their power and authority to the beast. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are called and with him are called and chosen and faithful. The angel said to me, 'The waters that you saw where the prostitute is seated are peoples and multitudes and nations and languages. And the ten horns that you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked and devour her flesh and burn her up with fire. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out his purpose by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. And the woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth.'" Oh boy, what do we do with this? John is writing to a diverse audience, to seven real churches. Smyrna has been threatened with imprisonment and death. Pergamum already has a martyr on their church rolls. But such violence does not seem to have been widespread yet. Laodicea is prospering economically. Some at Pergamum and Thyatira advocate a relaxed attitude concerning sacrifices to the emperors. And John is addressing that audience. God is giving him these visions. The basis of this chapter is Rome's presentation of herself as a strong and virtuous ruling power. It's interesting that we even have coins that were minted in the area of the seven churches around 71 AD, and they depict Roma, the goddess of Rome. And let me just give you a for instance here. this goddess Roma personified Roman power for the civilized world. She's always depicted as a noble woman draped in battle dress, reclining on the seven hills of Rome. On these coins, her foot stretches out to the Tiber River in front of her. Her left hand rests on a short sword, and her appearance is one of strength and sobriety, nobility there. Now, in keeping with that presentation of Rome itself, we have here not a noble woman, but a drunken whore. And God uses that to shake or strike or surprise the audience, those seven churches, into reality. Is Rome a noble woman, full of power and virtue? Quite the opposite. And we have that throughout this chapter. Now, this is one of many places throughout the book where the consensus of commentators in our day is that the book of Revelation is a critique of Rome. Well, let's look at it. The chapter falls out easily, as typically visions of this sort. You have an introduction. We have an introduction in the first six verses, an introduction to the city of Babylon. And then that's followed by an explanation of the vision of Babylon. Notice with me the introduction, and we have an introduction to the vision, and then the vision itself. Now, the introduction to the vision, notice in verse 1, one of the angels who's been busy pouring out the bowls of wrath says to John, "Come and I will show you the judgment of the great prostitute." This is the main point of the vision, we're told. Everything we see, don't be distracted, misled, go off on tangents. This is a vision about the judgment of the great prostitute. The image of prostitution is used to indict the city that rules the world. And notice, she's described as one in verse 1 who is seated on many waters. This is classically a picture of dominion, ruling as a seated king or queen. Notice in verse 2, "And she is with whom the kings of the earth have committed sexual immorality, and with the wine of whose sexual immorality the dwellers on earth have become drunk." Here we have, again, a picture of this metaphor of an immoral and intoxicating influence that the prostitute has over kings and nations of the earth. God willing, we'll see that connection made again in chapter 18, verses 2 and 3. As a metaphor, as this picture, it shows us the way the world finds the opulence of the ruling power, Rome, alluring, seductive, intoxicating. All the while they are being numbed with the intoxicating influence. They are numbed by the level of violence and bloodshed that characterizes that rule and undergirds it. Along with, of course, the idolatry that comes with it. Well, there's the introduction. Notice the vision itself then, where verse 3, John is carried away in the spirit into a wilderness. He's getting ready to see this vision. And then we have it at the end of verse 3 through the first part of verse 6. "I saw a woman seated on a beast," so forth. We have in the book of Revelation, especially in this chapter, three interlocking images that form the core of John's judgment against the empire. We have this image of a harlot, of this monster beast, and of this city named Babylon. Those are the three images. And each one is a criticism, a disparagement, a diminishing of Rome itself. Notice the description of the beast at the end of verse 3. "A scarlet beast that was full of blasphemous names, seven heads, 10 horns." John sees a personification of Rome rather than a literal Babylon. The description is almost word for word that we saw in chapter 13. There's the description of the beast, then of the woman that follows verse 4 to the first part of verse 6. Notice her appearance in verse 4. And it is a scathing contrast to the politically correct depiction of Rome. Instead of this virtuous huntress, this warrior fighting for what is right and virtuous, we have a debauched whore in a drunken stupor, a contemptible buffoon. Notice, she's arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold, jewels, pearls, holding in her hand a golden cup, not of the finest wine, but full of abominations and the impurities of her sexual immorality. This sexual immorality language is, of course, the Greek word porne. We get our English word pornographic, pornography, that sort of thing. The proper response to this depiction of her is that of revulsion. Revulsion. Perhaps you're feeling that already with the sermon and wish this was over. Well, that's an appropriate response to the imagery used here. Contempt. Notice her identity in verse 5. On her forehead was written the name of mystery, Babylon the Great, mother of prostitutes and of earth's abominations. Her name is stated on her forehead, revealing her nature. This was quite common. I tell you, you do a little study, and it's just amazing the things you find out. There's been this explosion of technical studies on prostitution in the Greek and Roman world in just the last few years. And honestly, there's so much we could just have a study on that. There were no zoning laws. You know, you didn't have an area of town that was a red light district. No, it was everywhere. And the early church fathers characteristically decried this. Everywhere you turned, there were prostitutes. And contrary to the, there was one wife of an emperor who often worked at a brothel just for entertainment. She's often set up almost as the pretty woman image of a prostitute. High-end, very expensive, that sort of thing. That's not characteristic. Typically, they were slave girls, and they were tattooed on their forehead with a name. And you can well imagine what would be there to make them alluring. But there's her identity in verse 5. It's interesting, too, to read the early church fathers. Y'all, they're of one mind. This was Rome. There was no debate among them. They understood what John was doing. They all were. There was a unanimous opinion of where he was going with this and what he was doing. Of course, Rome is called Babylon because of the Babylonian Empire, 7th and 8th century B.C., that was called great because of its military power and splendor. You know, if you've read through Daniel recently, the early chapters, for instance, Daniel chapter 4, verse 30, you see the great splendor and the mastery of the world that Babylon had. And now that name is used to describe Rome. Notice also then in she continues to drink. She's a drunken whore there in verse 6. I saw the woman drunk with what? The blood of the saints. Drunk on the blood of the martyrs of the Lord Jesus Christ. In the ancient literature, it's often commonly said of warriors, battlefields, and of, can't think of the descriptive word, but animals like vultures that would eat dead carcasses, that they were drunk on blood. They were thirsty for it. And that language is used of the harlot here. It's interesting. It's also used of Emperor Tiberius, who I think died in about 37 A.D. And we have examples of music, I guess it could be called that, or rhymes that were made to mock the emperor. And it was his bloodlust. He was drunk on blood. And the citizens of the Roman Empire knew that and wished for his death. Well, now there's the vision. Okay. Now we've already dabbled a bit in interpretation. But verse 7 to 18, we have the explanation of it. We have an introduction in verse 7. Then the interpretation of the beast, verses 8 to 14, and the interpretation of the woman, verses 15 to 18. And let's look at this, verse 7. When I saw her, I marveled greatly. The angel said to me, "Why do you marvel? I will tell you." Here it is. Here's the interpretation. "I will tell you the mystery of the woman and of the beast with the seven heads and ten horns that carries her." In typical fashion, in apocalyptic literature, you have an angelic guide that not only leads you to see the vision, but afterward explains it. And that's what he does here. Notice the interpretation of the beast in verses 8 to 14. We have its origin and description, verse 8, first part. "The beast that you saw was and is not and is about to rise from the bottomless pit and go to destruction." When I read this, I thought of one of the descriptions of the SS troops that came up when the Nazis took over Germany in the 1930s, well before America or its allies were drawn into war. But people who lived in Berlin, and this is a quote, said of the barbarism that was already there in the streets, said, "It was as if the devil and his hordes had crawled out of hell and walked upon the earth." If that's what was literally taking place in the streets of Berlin in the 30s, I wonder what it was. How would we describe this? Well, John's description is best. Notice the followers of the beast there in verse 8. At the end of verse 8, "The dwellers on earth," common description throughout the book of non-Christians, those who worship the beast. "The dwellers on earth whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world will marvel to see the beast, because it was and is not and is to come." They both worship the image, the beast, and the power behind it that we saw in chapter 13 being the devil himself, Satan, that is portrayed in chapter 12 as a great dragon. Notice the seven heads, verses 9 to 11. John writes, "Now mind you, this calls for a mind of wisdom. Assuming that God is the source of such, then all those readers that would be wise will get in line with God's view of reality. What is going on in the civilized world? What is taking place with the powers that be, this empire where these seven churches live? We need a discerning voice. We need a piercing glance to see behind the curtain what is really going on." That is what John is being shown here in these visions. For all the wealth, the military power, the luxury, the commerce that was going on around the world, around the Mediterranean, the legions of Roman forces that seemed unstoppable, there was something else taking place. And it is that which God is showing to John. The angel gives two interpretations of the head image. Notice, let's see. Yes, verse 9, again, this calls for wisdom. "The seven heads are seven mountains on which the woman is seated." Again, We've all heard of the seven hills of Rome, haven't we? Well, so did the early Christians and the church fathers that followed. So the seven heads are interpreted as the seven mountains, the seven hills where Rome, the city of Rome, was built. And notice verse 10, and they are also seven kings, five of whom have fallen. One is, the other is not yet come. And when he does come, he must remain but a little while. So the seven heads are interpreted in two ways. Geographically, seven hills of Rome. And politically, means rulers. The seven heads are also seven rulers. You know, if we were having a class, I'd show you a chart. Lots of charts available. Recommend those of Vern Poitras and R.C. Sproul, for instance. Well, we have this dual imagery of mountains and kings, underscoring that the beast embodies both the city of Rome and its emperors, its ruling power. The ten horns, verses 12 to 14, connote strength and power. And in the interest of time, I simply want to draw your attention to verse 14 here. In the discussion of the beast, we have a battle. They will make war on the Lamb, and the Lamb will conquer them. Why? How can he do that? He's the Lord of Lords, remember. He's the King of Kings. Remember, and those with him are called and chosen and faithful. The Lamb will conquer them. More on that in a moment. The interpretation of the woman, verses 15 to 18. Briefly, we have again this water imagery in verse 15, where typically in the Old and New Testaments, where a king is seated, it's a picture of dominion and power. And when it's over many waters, verse 15, we're told that's an imagery of peoples, multitudes, nations, languages. Then there's a civil war, a second battle, where the beast actually turns on the prostitute and devours her. Verses 16 and 17. The ten horns you saw, they and the beast will hate the prostitute. They will make her desolate and naked, devour her, burn her. Three metaphors. She'll be exposed like a harlot. Shameful nakedness here. She'll be devoured like a victim of a torn apart by a wild beast, and also burned like a city besieged. Why? What's the ultimate reason behind that battle? Verse 17. For God has put it into their hearts to carry out His purpose, by being of one mind and handing over their royal power to the beast until the words of God are fulfilled. Then again, verse 18, this identification. The woman that you saw is the great city that has dominion over the kings of the earth. There's a lot here, y'all. Tried to race through it. But I do want to draw some conclusion to this. Again, thinking of the seven churches, those threatened because of their faith, as at Smyrna, no doubt they would be encouraged to persevere. Our God is working His purposes out. He will enable us to endure. Let's remain faithful. Remain faithful to the Lord. Think of those at Pergamum and Thyatira, who are already adopting an easy attitude about the immorality of the emperor worship and the idolatry there. It's not so bad. Let's go along to get along. The fall of this despicable whore warns them that accommodating to the culture, going along with the way of life there in for the Roman Empire, means that you're setting yourself against God Himself. Because God is set to destroy Rome and her empire. Think of those in the church at Laodicea, where complacency was born of their financial prosperity. they see that purple garments and gold that the whore is wearing are no ultimate source of security in this life. But they are to resist the beguiling social and economic forces represented by the prostitute. I do want to conclude on this note. And it would be encouraging for the church that already had martyrs on its roll, that John had already told some of you are going to be thrown into prison and will lose your life there. They see here, among other places in the book, that the reign of injustice must and will come to an end. God not only judges people, but nations. Nations. And here he will fight on behalf of his people. What was the song that followed the parting of the Red Sea and the devastation of Pharaoh and his chariots? The people of Israel gathered, and Moses led them in a song in Exodus 15. And they described God how? God is a warrior. The horse and the rider he has thrown into the sea. Our God is a warrior. He protects, he defends his children. Thinking of our military, of course, is dear to my heart. As Marines and soldiers are trained to do, you run to the gunfire. You run to it. It becomes second nature. You don't, first of all, seek cover for yourself. You don't run away to tell someone else what's going on. You run to the gunfire. If we do that, if we train men and women to do that, it seems quite appropriate for those that would be defenders. How much more so our God? Our God, who's described in the book of Hebrews as the God who runs to the cry of his children. He doesn't run away. He doesn't mock us, say, well, try those to get over it. You'll be all right. He's not a God like that. But he is our Heavenly Father, and he is the divine warrior who fights on behalf of his people and runs to their cry. He runs to the gunfire in defense of his people. And that is what he promises to do here for these seven churches living in the midst of idolatrous, immoral Rome and her great power that God was going to bring to an end. The one we have worshipped today is still like that. Still. And the Son to whom we belong is not afraid of death. He's been there. And he has triumphed over it. I read an account in the current issue of Voice of the Martyrs magazine of Christians in India that are being attacked by radical Hindus who threaten to burn them alive. We've seen some of that recently, haven't we, on the news. And the Christians were saying, burn us. We're not afraid of that because we belong to one who is greater than death. It has more power than you can ever have. Can you imagine? That's our God to whom we belong.